For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way toward salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. Or in the words of Paul, at present we see indistinctly, as in a mirror, but then face to face. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave. Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford. In the cave with me, the two usual suspects, Mr. Timothy O'Donnell and Mr. Mark Tuttle. And we have a guest this week who I'll let you guys introduce. But just to mention, we're after Thanksgiving. We've probably overloaded our senses on Thanksgiving Day, and in tribute to my former pastor, rest his soul, I think we're all happy to have had just a wee bit of indigestion. So let's take a look at a fresh meal. Let's take a look at some fresh ideas, and let's introduce a fresh voice.
Okay, well, we have in the studio here, happy to say, we're both eager to introduce our special guest, Dr. Gwen Adams. Welcome to the Catholic Cave.
Hi, thanks so much.
Well, we've got, speaking of senses and sensibilities and sense appetite, we're going to talk philosophy with Dr. Gwen Adams here today. She blogs, she writes, she speaks, she works for the Diocese of Lafayette in Indiana here, and she's got a fascinating background. She earned her PhD from Maryvale in Birmingham, England. So we're going to talk about maybe what's going on over there in England a little bit. But welcome to the show. So great to have you.
Thank you very much. Exciting.
So do you mind if I call you Gwen?
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
Okay. I might even call you Dr. G.
Oh.
We had Dr. G on last week.
Do it.
And yeah. I know you listened to that show. That was a lot of fun. I am so grateful that you're here on the show. Tell us a little. I'd love for our audience to hear, and I'd like to learn a little bit more about sort of your background, your scholarly background. Sort of take us through a little bit of your trajectory, especially like a lot of people who listen to the Catholic Cave have an interest in philosophy, Catholic philosophy. Obviously, this show's focuses a lot on the intersection of faith and reason. Mm-hmm. So, you know, tell us a little bit about, you know, your undergraduate and some of your graduate studies. What got you what'd you major in and where'd you go? And what's sort of captivated your interest from an academic standpoint?
Sure. I'll back up even further just to high school. You're having, I think, Dr. Jonathan Sanford in a few weeks.
We are. Yeah.
Looking forward to that show.
Yeah. Mark went to UDallas, and that's where he's at now.
Okay. So Jonathan and I went to the same high school, a place called Trinity School, and they have three campuses, South Bend, Falls Church, Virginia, and St. Paul, Minnesota. And that school does a lot on having experiential knowledge on, you don't just hear about Socrates, you read Plato. You don't just read textbooks, you read original sources. They make you do plays, so you don't just hear about Shakespeare, but you do a play, and you do studio art. We all learned to do watercolors. It was a great education, and I went from there on to Christendom College in...
Very solid.
Yeah,
love
it's great.
Christendom.
It's great.
There might even be a guy there named Timothy O'Donnell.
Quit his day job, so...
Right, I get confused. I travel these Catholic circles, and they see my name, you know, like on a roster, and they're like eager to meet me, right? Because they think I'm the president. I'm like, nah, I'm the Indiana one, okay? It's so disappointing. They try to hide their disappointment, but I can see it.
Can I refer to you as Indiana Tim now?
Right, exactly.
That's funny.
And I've never met him. I'd love to meet him, but I feel like he's like my doppelganger, right? You know, or I'm his.
Or yeah, exactly. Oh, I have a story I'll tell as related to that as I'm going. So Christendom College, I majored in history.
We love history.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's my undergraduate degree.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Oh, it was great. And I really appreciate the student life there because they gave us a lot of experiences in Catholic culture. So processions and adoration and dances and parties. So you really got not just book learning about what it means to be Catholic or having a Catholic life, but lived experience. And that probably began to really interest me on how we learn through our senses, through experiences, not just lectures or being told. So I didn't do the straight degree from the BA to the PhD. I didn't actually have plans to get a higher degree. I went and became a youth minister at a parish called St. Boniface in Lafayette.
More experiential learning there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I'm still, that's my parish now, St. Boniface in Lafayette. And it was a great experience. And I spent a lot of time doing things like started an actors club, an actors guild.
Excellent.
So students were doing plays, things like that. And then the longer I was there, the more I just became interested in education and formation. So some people said, if you want to do this forever, you really ought to do some more formal teaching and you ought to get a higher degree. So that led to the MA in Catholic Studies at St. Thomas in the Twin Cities, and then eventually to the PhD at Maryvale. So,
right. So yeah. Tim mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. as we were getting ready for the show, that, you know, Maryvale is really ground zero for mm-hmm. for sort of conservative Catholicism in England. So, I guess, you know, you had, and I guess you could call Christendom to a certain extent ground zero for academic Catholicism here mm-hmm. in the United States. I mean, there's several universities.
Yeah, that doing really great work.
Exactly, yeah. But several universities could take that title, but mm-hmm. but certainly Christendom.
It's on that short
right.
list, yeah.
So I'm curious, what, you know, comparing and contrasting just a little bit your experiences there at Maryvale versus at Christendom versus, you know, other places in the United States.
Oh, yeah. Maryvale was interesting because it is an international distance school. So I had no experience of not being on a campus to do your studies. So it was difficult in some ways to be so far away from your advisors or your teachers and to be away from peers. So that was difficult. But there was also, they do these residentials, and it's part of their program, and to go 2 weeks every year and see what's going on in Birmingham and what's going on at the center, and then to meet these Catholics from around the world, that was very eye-opening, to meet non-American Catholics and see the struggles that they have in their own country, Norway, Cyprus.
Yeah, we forget how spoiled we are here in the United States a lot of times.
Yeah, and you know, when you go to college, any college, there will be people from out of state, and you'll feel like, oh, there's all these different people, but we still actually have a pretty homogenous, in some ways, kind of American
compared
Catholic culture.
Compared to someone from Norway.
Yeah. And
we got language and all sorts of different things going on there.
You know, I think we were talking right before the show started about pro-life things. So if you go to Christendom, the whole college will go to the March for Life. And the March for Life in D.C. is huge, thousands and thousands of people. When I was at Maryvale, I went to the first national English March for Life, and it was amazing that they were having it, but of course it wasn't thousands and thousands of people, so
right you know. Yeah, so the culture is the culture is a little bit more steeped, I guess, in Christianity here in the United States. And so, you know,
which is kind of odd because it's newer.
Right. It's newer. Right. Right. But yeah, I think we forget that.
Is it the secularization, do you think, that
yeah,
that's really the dominant?
I feel like what we're dealing with right now, they dealt with 40 years or so ago. Mm-hmm. There's also the whole history from the 1500s onward with the Reformation and Henry VIII. It's interesting to meet them because I think you would be bitter and kind of jaded because it's just been really hard to be Catholic in the UK for
well, when it's right. criminalized.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
You know.
But they're not. I met this wonderful lady who owned Stoner House, which is where Edmund Campion, they had, a lot of people.
Yeah.
That's where he wrote the Campion's Brag. It's amazing. And she was just very cheerful. And she said, "You just keep going. You just keep going."
Oh, that stiff upper lip.
I love that. I just thought, "Oh, she wasn't having a pity party at all." It was amazing. Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic. So, as you were working your way through, say, graduate studies, Who were some of the thinkers that influenced you or captured your imagination?
I'd probably say Alasdair MacIntyre is the most.
Okay, we love that guy. Most, yeah,
I know.
Right. Notice she didn't say Hegel.
Right. Hey, no. You cannot understand MacIntyre without understanding Hegel. Well, that's his background. That's his tradition.
I'll
claim him as one of my own, even if he is Scottish. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He's interesting. I mean, you say the name and you get different reactions. All through my studies, I say his name and people say, "Oh, my favorite," or they say, "Oh, him." You know, yeah. Stanley Howard Ross says he's sort of almost become this phrase where even people who haven't read him have an opinion about him.
Right.
Yeah. But we've talked a lot about MacIntyre. We try not to drop names here in the cave,
so that
you know the listeners can kind of absorb a little bit. So we've actually talked a lot about MacIntyre. I like to drop names though.
Yep. I don't hear.
You know, it is funny because you've got to have a good mix. So the people who are familiar with a lot of the thinkers, they want to hear the names. They want to know who we're talking about. But then, you don't necessarily need to know the names of all these philosophers to be able to pick up on their thoughts, be able to pick up on, what they were thinking or where they went. So we try,
but we're not terribly successful.
That's where we're in the cave.
Right, exactly.
They don't let us out too much.
Yep. So So MacIntyre's thesis is that the Enlightenment went horribly wrong, particularly when it came to ethics and morals. Mm-hmm. And we've lost the language. We've lost the ability to coherently have a conversation. I think this past election, what's going on in the culture, I mean, I think it's just validation of what MacIntyre was saying, that there's this incommensurability of moral views going back and forth. So, but he also talked a lot about community and how to a certain extent ethics have to be embodied within a social community that has its own goals, has its own standards, has its own way of judging things. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious. You mentioned MacIntyre. It's pretty big, wide open field to kind of look at. What particularly drew your attention there?
I was really interested in how much time he spends on the importance of being embodied, especially for learning.
Yeah.
And when he talks about communities, he spends a lot of time talking about the kind of community you have through a practice or a shared activity. He talked about chess, or even passing on a community is a kind of communal activity, and you're part of the people who've gone before you, and you're passing it on to the next generation. And the role of being embodied seemed important. I was really interested in understanding parish relationships, and I wanted to see through his lens why it might matter if people have spent a long time interacting with each other. And he's just really useful for illuminating that, because he talks about how we do learn through our senses. So we have to engage not just what people say to us, but also how they behave, because there's a complete unity between what's going on inside your head and what you're doing, even if you can't articulate that.
Right.
What
fascinates me is that connection goes even deeper than that. I mean, when you start looking at a lot of our language, a lot of our language comes from our embodied experience. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you're, if you have a little baby, for instance, you can kind of watch them as they start to pick up, they start to pick up concepts like in or out based on their own experience of it. And, they start to get a sense of themselves versus, others out there off of their own sort of lived experience. And so, language to a certain extent comes to us from our bodily actions and our bodied experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We need to take a short break right here, and we'll be back with more with Dr. Gwen Adams right after this.
I've got the spirit.
Hi, this is Teresa Tomeo from Catholic Connection.
Hi, this is Barbara McWiggin, host of The Good Fight here on Catholic Radio Indy.
Hi, everybody. This is Dr. Ray Guarendi, host of The Doctor Is In here on Catholic Radio Indy.
Hi, I'm Al Cresta, and you can join me for Cresta in the Afternoon here on Catholic Radio Indy.
The best of EWTN plus great local programming. That's what you get when you support Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle, here with Timothy O'Donnell, Kent Blanford, and our special guest, Dr. Gwen Adams. And we are talking today a little bit about everything, honestly.
It is Thanksgiving weekend, so the table is full.
But, you know, honestly, I think what we're getting at to a certain extent is Catholic community. We're talking a little bit about Catholic community, and we're talking about ethics. And so we were talking about Alistair MacIntyre, who I think whenever you talk about ethics and community, his name looms large over any discussion you're going to have about it. And right before the break, we were talking a little bit about how ethics are embodied. They're embodied within communities, etc. And one way to characterize MacIntyre's thought a little bit is to kind of talk about the priority that he puts of sociology over ethics. So for him, to a certain extent, sociology and our interactions with other people, etc., those are not chronologically prior, but logically prior to a certain extent to the ethics that are embodied within those institutions or within the ethics, et cetera, like that. So you've got an interesting perspective on that, because not only are you a philosopher, but you're also, you work at a parish. I mean, you kind of live that out within a parish. So I'm curious, your observations from being on the inside, does that seem to bear out that the ethics of a particular parish are, to a certain extent, that parish life is sort of logically prior to the ethics and everything that are espoused there at the parish?
I think so, because the experience of the life there is teaching a young person before they can articulate it, or even if the people who are sort of organizing the life at the parish can articulate it. It's articulating a certain way, the goods that you prioritize or the way you view the world. And I was thinking, just this past week was the Feast of Christ the King.
That's a good one.
And so I was
do it every year, I think.
Oh yeah. It's great. My parish, St. Boniface, does a feast or a party every year for this, and this is something that I had started when I was a youth minister with a friend of mine, Jessica Hickey, and the party's now 16 years old, so that the children who have grown up there, they just think this is normal, and they couldn't write you an essay on. On this, but to have a dance with swing dancing and a dance competition and chocolate for prizes, that was preceded by Vespers and adoration, they just have all these really visceral experiences of what is important. God is important, being worshiped here with this community in this regular way. So they're sort of learning theology before they are getting that prior formation, sensory, imaginative formation, before the intellectual formation. I think that's kind of what MacIntyre is talking about. If you want to understand what makes a community work, he really promotes doing sociological studies and understanding how they actually function.
Right. Yeah. You have to have a theory and an understanding of human interaction and sociology and human action to a certain extent before you can start to understand morality, ethics, etc. I mean, the sociology comes prior, which, that's not usually the way we think about ethics and morals. We think about it as a set of rules or a set of virtues or something like
that. Or you'll have
like
a class on religion.
Exactly.
But actually, since you were 2 months, you've been learning about what is good, what is beautiful.
But really, honestly, when you get into those classes, your moral views for the most part are usually set already. I mean, Tim, you teach ethics at the collegiate level. How many of
those
your
poor students?
Really, honestly, how many of your students though change their minds based on your class?
Precious few.
Exactly.
Precious few.
It's hard. Yeah.
I like to use a. It's on YouTube. I love to use a debate between Christopher Hitchens as the atheist, again, who's up against in debates. It's a formal debate with Dr. Craig. Some of you might know him from Biola. So Dr. Craig is very well schooled in, he's got a PhD in philosophy, and then he's got a PhD in theology up against. But anyway, it's really interesting because Dr. Craig lays out these very specific, compelling, logically sequential arguments for the existence of God. And then Hitchens is much more of an emotive appeal to evil in the world, and seems like there's waste and chaos and things like that. And so before I show the video, I think it's called The God Debate on YouTube, I'll take a poll and say, how many, raise your hands if you believe in the existence of God, how many are agnostic, and how many are committed atheists. And then I'll take the same kind of poll after this, and then I'll ask them to write a paper as to why they did or didn't change their positions. And inevitably, the papers tend to, those who are atheists and don't move off that, or agnostic, don't move in the direction to affirm the existence of God, very frequently are engaged in a kind of, have these prior ideological commitments that don't allow them to successfully contend with the evidence of an opposing view.
Yeah.
And that transcends not just to that sort of God versus no God kind of debate. I find that very, very common among adults outside the classroom too, that we really do have a very difficult time. And Socrates, right? Socrates pointed to this. This is why he said the unexamined life is not worth living. We have to examine our life to see if to uncover falsehoods that we, and mistakes that we might be making. And I think that's it's very difficult for us as human beings. It requires a great deal of what? Humility.
Yeah, right? It does. It does, because it requires us to go back and kind of examine and judge all of our prior experiences. I mean, to go back and not only prior experiences, but like I said, those groups we've been involved with, and the beliefs of those groups and the customs of those groups, examining those, it really, those become a part of us. I mean, those are really part of who you are. It's hard to divorce yourself from your childhood, how you were brought up, hard to divorce yourself from your country or your community or your parish. I mean, wherever you belong, to divorce yourself from that long enough to be able to sort of examine those beliefs that you were brought up in.
Or even you're absolutely right. It is. It feels like it comes across to me as if it's almost as if they would have to sort of self-abandon. There's a self-abandonment that would have to happen versus, and there's not a lot of training, I would say, in critical thinking around how to intellectually suspend belief long enough to hear the other side on its own terms. I think is a really important skill to develop, an intellectual skill to develop, and rarely taught, if at all, or few people seem to be able to do it.
Yeah,
everything seems to come through a kind of lens. That's very
from your experience.
Yeah,
but I would say,
which isn't a bad thing per se in and of itself. But there also has to be that ability to sort of put yourself in another person's shoes, so to speak, intellectually, to better understand, to put ourselves inside of an idea that's not of our own.
It's a process. I mean, it's a process of continually stepping out of yourself to examine, and then, kind of...
It's a uniquely human activity, I would say.
I would say
that's
so,
what makes us different from, say, the smartest chimpanzee down at the zoo.
Yeah. But I'd have a lot of sympathy for a person. I mean, it's pretty hard to sustain an intellectual position if you don't have any kind of experiential knowledge to ground it. I think
agree.
I don't think you should say, well, I've never experienced that. I mean, somebody who's never prayed before and just says, well, I don't even know that, and won't try.
Right.
But I would say to a person, an intellectual knowledge of God that didn't have any experience in prayer would, I don't know if it could last. It would be really hard to sustain your belief without...
Well, that's Dr. Craig's fifth proof is this interior experience.
Yeah,
right? Thing. I agree with you.
They bolster each other.
But I think to move into that, some people will start with an experience of God, and that's the point. That's what the tipping point for conversions. Others, though, make that intellectual move first and then arrive at that experience, right? And so... which way are we operating? But you're right. You eventually have to have both. You're right to sustain it.
But I think it's important to keep in mind when we're talking about evangelization, we're talking about teaching others about the faith, that a lot of times it's the bringing those people along on the experiences.
Yeah, come and see.
And, I came across a book from the late 1940s, so just after World War II, on Catholic evangelization. So it was all these conversion stories.
Okay.
And a lot of them revolved around Eucharistic adoration. I was fascinated by that. The first entree that the converts had was being taken to Eucharistic adoration, mm-hmm. and experiencing the prayer and experiencing the holiness and it, you know, just the whole experience of Eucharistic adoration. Mm-hmm. I had a friend in grad school who was kind of converting, and I told him, you know, if you really want to get to know Catholicism, go to Eucharistic adoration. Mm-hmm. That's really where you kind of see the fullness of Catholicism. But once again, it's that sort of experiencing it. I mean, there's a lot of theology there, but it's not explicit theology. Yeah. You're living it out.
I find it perpetually fascinating that we don't just have the teachings being handed on from Christ, but that he has set up sacraments, that these incredibly physical, tangible ways to connect to him through water and oil and through what looks like bread. I just think that he is so understanding of, I have a body, I need to be with you in a very physical kind of way, and adoration's power just kind of testifies to that.
I heard a priest describing it as like, you know, it's sort of giving, it's like your soul in, you know, is there before our Eucharistic Lord, just sort of being bathed in his light, you know, and I just like, that's why I want to go.
Yeah, exactly. But we're made for that. You know, we're made for that sort of physical experience of God. You know, we're made for the sacraments. We're made to receive Christ.
But that takes
as his body and blood, you know, physically. You know, we're made to receive baptism by having water dumped on our head.
Yeah, but that requires a certain understanding of the human person, which we're going to put Dr. Gwen on the spot. So I've heard it said, and we talked about this a little bit last time with Dr. T a little bit. So tell us a little bit about, so the human, you know, what do you think the human person is? Are we basically sophisticated meat machines? I mean, I've heard that before. And if we are, then it would seem sacramentals, you know, the sacramental life wouldn't really be all that important.
Oh, so we have a body and we have a soul?
Yeah.
Gosh, there's so much on this. C.S. Lewis and Aquinas and McIntyre talking about, we don't just have a body.
I didn't hear Hegel, Mark.
Sorry.
Hegel's right up there with him. He's talking about it too.
Yeah.
Nope. I didn't hear it. Sorry.
Yeah. No, we don't.
Little inside baseball listeners. Sorry about that.
Maybe he said this. We don't just have a body. We are a body.
No, he did.
Yeah.
No, I think he was the original to a certain extent before all these guys. He was talking about how, you got to have a body and a spirit, and the two go together, and the two develop together. Yep.
Mm-hmm. In a fused in a way that's almost incomprehensible to understand how they interact with each other, but they do. And
I think that's one of your interests. I think, right, is Dr. Gwen, around this, how do we know things? And we were talking about a little bit earlier in the show. I'd like to bring us kind of back to that, about your understanding, you know, what's your understanding of how the human person learns and grows and education? And you share with our listeners a little bit, some of them may just be tuning in. What do you think tell me a little bit about experience and the role of experience in learning.
Okay. Well, I'll make a little pitch for my blog, christianintegration.blogspot.com.
Love it. You gotta recommend it.
Thank you. Where I go into much more detail about these ideas. But I would say that we learn through our senses, and they impact our imagination and our memory first. And from there, I'm stealing all this from other great thinkers, but from there we begin to develop our ideas and make judgments about things and to understand things. So really good thought is always grounded in experience. And if your experience conflicts with your thought, then you need better experiences and better thoughts. I mean, you want to reconcile that. It wouldn't be good for a human being to keep them divorced that way. So
that'd be a kind of disintegration.
A disintegration, yeah. Right. So I stole that term, Christian integration, from a writer and a philosopher, Frederick Wilhelmson. He taught in Texas. He's related to people who founded Christendom. And he has a book on Hilaire Belloc, being an integrated man. And he's got this idea that every one of us has three characters in us, from a novel by Belloc called The Four Men. Belloc's one of the characters.
Someone was just writing about that, like in Crisis Magazine or something.
I hope so. Yeah. I wish there was a Belloc revival the way there's been a Chesterton revival.
Yeah,
I want more of his books back in print.
I agree.
So He's got this novel, The Four Men, with a character named Grizzlebeard, one called Sailor.
I love that name, Grizzlebeard.
Yeah, he's this.
I want that like as my show name.
I was going to say, you kind of.
Because there's already a Timothy O'Donnell in the Catholic circle.
So now I want to be
Grizzlebeard. Oh, yeah, you need your own name. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. The other one's the sailor, and the third one's the poet. And the poet is sort of represents the spiritual side of man, the man that's called for God, the desire for God. And we all have that in us, longing for our final home. And then Sailor and Grizzlebeard, to me, they seem kind of to represent how we're creatures of time and space. In time, we have a need for stories. We have a need to understand where we came from, where we're going. Grizzlebeard tells this. And then Sailor is just... he's about wonder and experience and being in your place, where you are right now, very aware of that. And look at these characters and get an idea of, well, I've gotten an idea of, well, how would you want to educate if we have these aspects of our personality in us? And that's offering really visceral experiences to young people and to families.
Let me ask you a little bit. I know it's bad to philosophize from the hard cases. But what about for folks who maybe didn't have the greatest experiences, say growing up, or some of the formative years, or let's say maybe I had a good home life, but maybe the kind of education I got mm-hmm. was lacking. Let's say maybe it was overly secular or something like that. What are some of the ways we might go about gaining better experiences for ourselves, like you said, or gaining some of the better ideas that we may need to equip ourselves with to more fully integrate as Catholics?
Yeah, that's kind of the point of the blog, is to give ideas for people at any stage in life to find these experiences. There's a lot of ideas about...
Well, Mark's right here. Give him one.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's like what you said of going to adoration and trying to, in your spiritual life, have this experience of interacting with God. I give a talk about being really real with God, like Job, telling him how you were really feeling. We're not supposed to go to God like Esther with the king, like, oh, now I'll be all sort of very formal and tell you what I'm not actually thinking. So,
Right. Mm-hmm. Having that experience mm-hmm. of, I guess, God's friendship to a certain extent, you mm-hmm. know, in and through your prayer life. You know, these experiences, the idea of trying to experience God, it's a very Catholic idea. Mm-hmm. I mean, it goes, and it's a part of our tradition that I think has been lost. I mean, going back to Catholicism in England, you had the mystery plays, you had the whole history mm-hmm. of basically people enacting and putting on plays to live out their faith mm-hmm. in that way. And this is a fairly illiterate society when you think about it. Mm-hmm. So this is how they learned their faith. This mm-hmm. is how they became catechized. And they were very well catechized mm-hmm. through this, you know, by putting on plays, by watching the plays, by living that out, by going to shrines and, mm-hmm. and various saintly shrines. You had a very robust Catholic culture because of the way they, to a certain extent, played Catholicism.
Mm-hmm. Or stained glass pictures. I mean, just a very visceral pictures and experiences.
Sacred art.
Yeah. That really would teach the faith and give you an experience of what is good, what is true, what is beautiful.
You know, unfortunately, you know, we've talked a lot about modernism and you know, some of the downsides of modernism that mm-hmm. have come about. And one of them is, you know, we've got this very intellectualized faith life now. Mm-hmm. You know, we went through this movement of trying, I think, to strip away all of the, you know, we took the statues out of the churches to a great extent. We tried to strip away that visceral side of Catholicism. Mm-hmm. So are you seeing a revival of this? Are you sensing that, you know, we're kind of turning, or do you feel like you're swimming upstream with what you're saying?
I'd say yes and no. I'm really encouraged by some of the many vocations that are coming out and some of the movements that are some of the things that vocation directors are trying to do. So I'm thinking I do some work for Vianney Vocations. I wrote their high school curriculum, which Indianapolis's archdiocese bought. And that has a lot of stories in it and sort of theatrical role-playing activities for students to stand up and interact with each other and talk with a priest or talk with a religious sister about these things. So it's very experiential. Or Father Hasser's the vocations director for Diocese of Lafayette, and he runs a camp, which is modeled off of Camp Wetiwa in Colorado. And that's got students out all day doing archery and then talking about the activity of archery. What are you learning? And if we're aiming at things in our life, that's
very Aristotelian, yeah. Right?
It's really amazing to have a student use their whole body and experience something and then use it as an analogy for a lot of, you know, all aspects of their life, virtue, God, prayer. Yeah.
I know some young men who've been on those. It's exhausting. They love it. They keep them busy. Mm-hmm. By the end of the day, you know, they're worn out and ready to listen. Yeah. Right? By the campfire. Yeah. So,
and, you know, to a certain extent, though, I mean, yeah, that's a camp that's set aside to specifically do that. But, you know, we can take that. And, I mean, that's kind of what we should be doing in our life as lay people. I mean, we should be sacralizing to a certain extent, you know, our everyday activities and using those, you know, to pray. You know, the whole concept of your work is prayer, you know, that integration of what you're doing with your relationship with God and trying to integrate, you know, your faith life into your bodily daily activities. It's great to, I guess, to have a camp to where you can sort of learn how to do that and then, you know, take that as an adult. I'd love to go on that as an adult.
Yeah. This is just an ongoing conversation you could have, because I was thinking schools have this conversation about, is our calendar, a Catholic school, is our calendar set up in a way that recognizes the liturgical year? So, for example, we all work Mondays. And so do we have a test on Monday so that on Sunday, everybody's working really, really hard? Teachers are prepping and students are studying all. So that's a very physical experience, which sort of prioritizes that Sunday is not important. Right. It's a work day.
Friday is a much better day to have tests, because then you can sort of sort of participate in Christ's passion,
you know,
while you're taking
Right.
Yeah. Good Lord. This is very visceral. Yeah.
The sweating blood.
So, that's the kind of conversation that every part of your life is embodying or prioritizing something. So what does this prioritize or teach?
Right.
That's a good point. I mean, I a lot of people I talk to, you know, the most stressful evening of the week is Sunday night, because they're thinking about what the next 5 days are going to entail. And it creates a lot of anxiety and stress on them.
Yeah. And, you know, sometimes it's just out of your control. But other times you think, gosh, if we could choose, what do we want to do? What teaches better? What offers a better experience?
Right.
So,
right. Well, we're listening to Dr. Gwen Adams here in the Catholic Cave. Thank you so much for coming in. We've had just a great time so far, and we've got more questions for you. So tell us a little bit about, I'd love to go back to a little bit here before, we've got a few minutes before the next break. I want to go back to this, your dissertation.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And sort of, tell us a little bit about what you focused on and maybe some of the learnings that came out of that.
Okay. There's a book by Eamon Duffy called The Stripping of the Altars, which is about...
I've read that. Oh, it's a good one. It's
So he's arguing that through really detailed research that faith life in England prior to the Reformation was very vibrant and very popular on every level of society. And then really, really fast, it all disappeared. And I was thinking about my particular parish, St. Boniface, and wondering, could, you know, now we've had a certain way of life for 20, 25 years, could that all disappear overnight, or would it just go on? And I began to wonder, so what is it about the parish that makes it be that way? Or if you have any good parish, could that parish stay good, or what's it dependent on? And I wondered, is it dependent on the pastor having been there for a certain period of time, or certain long-term parishioners? So the research became about, are there any goods if you've had long-term embodied interaction between parishioners and pastors? So I did some theology work on what it is to be a parish, and then I looked at the Benedictines because they take a vow of stability. So I thought their spirituality could offer a lot. And then I did a study of three parishes in the Diocese of Lafayette. And I learned a lot of things about embodied interaction. Very interesting.
Share a couple. What sort of comes to mind?
So the main thing was that you need some long-term parishioners or a pastor to begin and sustain complex projects. So something like Our Lady of Mount Carmel's Merciful Help Center that offers so much outreach, that is hard to start and build up if you don't have some people who are involved for the long haul.
And by that, you mean like 10, 20 years?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Okay.
The next
or
thing.
Or longer even.
Or longer, yeah.
But a lifetime. A lifetime.
It can be. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then the next two things were a parish is supposed to have familial relationships, including the priest. There's a lot of theology about the priest being a family member of the parish or the particular church. And it's really hard to build up a familial relationship in a parish if people are moving in and out, in and out. And
Or the priest moves.
Which
happens a lot, uh-huh. right? Our priests are always moving around, right?
Yeah. And that the ability to have short terms, 6-year terms, is kind of experimental since the 1983 code. So I was sort of looking at, how is that working out in parishes? And what I found through the study was that it seems to take people at least, it can go 6 months to 5 years to start having a relationship. Mm-hmm. Just to start it, to feel comfortable enough to give or receive help or give or receive advice. And after 5 years sometimes, then you can begin to build on that. Then you can have your first conversation about vocations.
And then someone moves.
I saw a marked difference in participation in Eucharistic adoration before 6 years. It was just after 6 years, people are settled enough or they have enough time or they're aware enough to engage in that. So it seemed like I think we kind of take that for granted, how fast you can build relationships up and begin having deeper formation going on. Yeah.
Yeah, well, let's continue talking about this a little bit right after our break.
Right.
Three things keep Catholic Radio Indy on the air. One is our fervent desire to spread the gospel message. Two is your donations to the station. We couldn't survive without them. And three is underwriting from area businesses. Every month, these businesses make donations to the station. Please support them. Visit their stores, send them an email, or call them. Let them know that you appreciate their support of Catholic Radio. It's a great way to thank our underwriters for their very important support.
You're listening to Catholic Radio Indy, converting the culture to Christ through radio, featuring 100% Catholic programming 24/7. Do your friends a favor. Tell them about Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Grizzle Beard, also known as Tim O'Donnell.
I'll claim being Sailor. Yeah, right, that's pretty cool.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And if you don't know what we're talking about there, you're going to have to catch us on the Podbean replay and hear. We're talking about Belloc's book.
I'll be the piebald to your Grizzle
right.
Beard.
Right, and Kat, you're the pirate. Well, we're back in the cave with Mark Tuttle, Dr. Gwen Adams, our sidekick and producer, Kent Blanford. We were talking to Dr. Adams about parish life, parish community. Love to hear some suggestions on what are some effective ways for us to build really vibrant, strong Catholic identity communities in our parishes.
Okay. Well,
thank you. That's all the time we have. No. Yeah. I mean, that's a big question, right? I mean, I feel like it's almost unfair to kind of put you on the spot like that, but we'd love to hear your ideas.
I think you mainly need money. No, and I don't like that.
Lots of it.
Well, the conclusion of my dissertation was that it should be part of discernment to see if you would stay at the parish. But sometimes part of your discernment would say that I think a priest needs to be moved, or the priest says, I need to be moved, or a parishioner, we need to go for schools or for work. So if your time is limited, but I think it's always worth to pray about, if your time is limited, what can you do in the meantime, just, this week or this year at the parish? And I think the first thing that will benefit everybody is to take a look at the liturgical year and think about what do we do as a parish to celebrate this particular feast together. Some feasts are hard. So Christmas, everybody has family plans already. You might not say, as a parish family, we're going to do Christmas together. It'd be, but there's something, maybe your parish's patron. There should be some way where the parish comes together to celebrate, and you can make it really big with Vespers and adoration. There should be an element of prayer that's very beautiful and touches on beautiful music, something you hear. Beautiful sights, flowers, or a procession outside is so nice. You know, mm-hmm. if you have flowers or pennants that you can carry, or singing, and then a really good party to celebrate. Pope Benedict always talked about Corpus Christi growing up, his memories of that, and he mm-hmm. bases a lot of theology in describing first just this experience that he had. And I think if you can offer people of any age, whatever background, a lot of people hook into the faith that way by having seen and been at something really exciting and beautiful. So,
yeah, I mean, you think back to your own experiences growing up, whatever mm-hmm. whatever faith community you, mm-hmm. you grew up in, it's those types of events that you remember. I mm-hmm. mean, you don't necessarily remember the homilies, and you don't mm-hmm. necessarily remember the faith formation or the religious ed lessons, but you do remember the festivals. You remember, you know, if there were processions, you know, you remember those types of activities, and that's what stays with you. And I think you're right. I think that's also what kind of keeps people coming back to the faith. So mm-hmm. Do you think it's a sort of, I mean, everybody's talking about this crisis of the millennials, you know, the millennial generation, you know, kind of
the nuns.
The yeah. nuns, exactly.
N-O-N-E-S. Yeah. Not the religious sisters, but
It's too much of an exaggeration to say they're leaving the church in droves, but that's only an exaggeration.
There is
a little bit.
They are falling away.
Right, mm-hmm. right. Do you think this sort of lack, I guess, of those types of celebrations and that kind of thing for the last 20 years or so mm-hmm. is contributing to that?
I would place a bet on that. Yeah, I think so. I would say I wouldn't want anybody in their 20s to find more affection and more joy in someplace besides the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
And I don't fault them for wanting to find happiness. And that's one of the most popular classes at Harvard, The Search for Happiness, titled something like that. Yeah.
And there's so much competing with parish life for your time, mm-hmm. for mm-hmm. your affections. I mean, mm-hmm. it's so easy just to say, you know what, instead mm-hmm. of going to whatever's going on at the parish this Friday, mm-hmm. I'm just going to go catch a movie somewhere, mm-hmm. or I'm going to go to whatever, you know, my favorite sporting team's game is, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And find it that way, I guess. Find mm-hmm. that camaraderie in those types of activities rather than in parish life.
What, what effect do you see technology playing on, say, the millennial generation, our ability to connect with them with, say, the true, the good, the beautiful, when there's smartphones and there's texting and literally, it seems like an infinite amount of mm-hmm. really glamorous distractions at mm-hmm. our fingertips.
Mm-hmm.
How do we, that is capturing their imagination.
Mm-hmm.
How do we, I don't want to say compete with that, but how do we offer an alternative to that?
Well, that's hard. I think you do offer alternatives, because I don't think that those things necessarily fill the need for a sensory experience. There is an experience going on, but it doesn't really...
It's like a swamp, though. It's a mile wide and an inch deep,
and
right?
And it's really sort of visual, and not the smells, and it's not really being in a physical space. You're still just at home on the couch, you know?
Right.
And it's missing the embodied interaction. I think that's a huge thing, because I wouldn't say that we're just going to offer a movie at the parish, the end, and we'll try to compete with a movie that's down the street, because what's really important is the personal relationship that you're trying to build with a particular young person, an experiential relationship.
I think one of the things that's truly missing in the world of the millennials is the tactile.
Yeah.
And that is something that the church offers in it. Look at all mm-hmm. of the sacraments. Mm-hmm. There's a tactile mm-hmm. aspect to every sacrament. Mm-hmm. There's the oils, there's the water, mm-hmm. there's the laying on of hands. That's something that a virtual reality can't give you.
Right. Yeah. And even a lot of the sacramental activities like processions, like Eucharistic adoration, you know, those types of things, they offer that same sort of tactile experience. You know, the genuflecting as you enter the chapel, the kneeling to pray, you know, all of that offers that sort of full sensory experience.
Yeah. And I love the feel of my rosary beads when I'm praying the rosary, you know. I have a military rosary too, so that's a way to kind of bring two worlds together, right? So the cord is made out of parachute cord, so that's kind of fun.
Yeah.
But there is something about that. So Dr. Gwen, when you say embodiment, embodied like experiences, what do you mean by that? What are you getting at?
Oh, experiences that engage as many senses as possible and that really are in reality. You can't control them. You can't cut them off necessarily. You can't predict them. So when you're relating with a real human being, like in this room right now when we're talking, I don't know what questions you're going to ask me, whereas if I was scrolling through a blog, I just say, I'm done reading. The end. Yeah. You know. And so it's in some ways, it's not exactly interacting with reality because you're so the boss of it. Whereas a real embodied
the control,
right?
We love to be in control.
We've got you trapped here in the cave. you can't leave.
I love these silhouettes you got going on here. Right.
Those aren't chains. Keep looking forward.
That seatbelt is for your safety.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. You know, it's interesting, just as a side note, I think that's the case for, you just made the case for why the intellect is immaterial, because it can't be predicted. This is one of the things like, not the name drop, but Mortimer Adler talks about a lot about this. It's the unpredictability of where a conversation would go. This is why he thought artificial intelligence would never become truly human, because he used the analogy of the two of us, you know, sitting around having a conversation. There's no way to predict, and we had that conversation every day for an hour for 2 months. There's no good way to predict where that conversation would be in 2 months. And that's a completely immaterial faculty that we have. So, but anyway, that takes us far afield. So let's go back to parish community life. What are some other things that we ought to consider in terms of instilling what level of commitment would it take? Does it take to kind of bring these sorts of things about? And who's going to collaborate with us on this?
Well,
how do you find collaborators? Let me put it to you that way, right? Because you can't do it. You can't do it by yourself.
No, it does take a lot of work. And as you make mistakes or get overworked, or you realize, oh, this is so hard, it is. You realize you have to ask for help and. To look for people who have enjoyed it in the past and want to see it done again. So you always start small. There's only, you know, 10 people at this, and you did all the work and took out all the trash. But then next year, you know, you ask some of those people to help. And some of the most fun about starting an event in a parish is the friends that you're making while you're doing it. There's a lot of relationship you build up just by working together. Yeah. It's really nice.
Particularly men, you know. And that's another area. You talk about people sort of becoming disengaged from parish life, et cetera. I mean, there's a big crisis of men not necessarily feeling welcome.
Fatherhood.
And so, you know, these types of activities where you're engaging, I mean, that's how men interact. I mean, we don't get together for a cup of coffee usually to talk, unless you're Tim and I.
But
for the most part, you know, men interact by doing things together. You
start with a project.
Exactly.
Right?
Having a project, and that's how we bond, is by having some other goal beyond just the socialization.
The cave,
exactly.
I think it's good for a parish to try to offer some kind of service, whether it's just the guys selling Christmas trees or something for the poor, or running a camp for... Because when you're running the camp, it's actually forming you as you're taking care of younger ages. So, that kind of service is formative.
Yeah, and that's one aspect of faith formation that I've liked. Faith formation for kids is that there's a big emphasis now on service, of trying to get those kids to take on service projects. Because you're right, that's as much forming their faith as the theology that we're trying to get to stick. Mm-hmm.
And that's about all the time we have for the Catholic Cave today. Sorry, folks, that one went kind of quick. We're going to have Dr. Gwen Adams back sometime.
Give us your blogspot real quick again.
Christianintegration.blogspot.com.
Check it out, and we'll catch you next time on The Cave. Happy Thanksgiving, and enjoy those leftovers.
Thanks for joining us for this edition of The Catholic Cave. If you have a question or comment regarding this program, please address an email to Kent, K-E-N-T, at CatholicRadioIndy.org or call 317-870-8400. Replays of this program are available on podcast at CatholicRadioIndy.org. Just click on the programming tab, then go to podcasts of local programs.